Okay, welcome everybody. So it's a pleasure to have today Alison Tezin as our speaker at the Quantum Foundation's virtual seminars. And he will talk about contextuality by default for behaviors in compatibility scenarios. Thanks.
Okay, so hi everyone. So I would like to thank all the organizers again. I'm very grateful to be here. And today I am going to talk about contextuality by default for behaviors in compatibility scenarios. This is a paper I have written in collaboration with Rafael and Barbara. And well, in this paper, we deal with contextuality in the sense of joint measurement. So I would like to start discussing what I mean by a joint measurement and introduce contextuality in this sense. So suppose we have a physical theory F, and in this theory, we have two postulates, P1 and P2. And we are thinking about a physical theory in which we can define states, observables, and outcomes. So for example, quantum theory or classical theory, or quantum mechanics or classical mechanics, sorry. And okay, so let's introduce this postulate. So postulate one is a postulate, it is a rule which ascribes a probability of obtaining an outcome beta, given that we are performing a measurement B in the stage row. So that's what postulate one tells to us. And postulate two is a rule which determines the stage of a system right after a measurement. So we have to. What is the stage after we obtain outcome beta in a measurement of B, given that's the stage right before the measurement was rho? So for example, we know that in quantum theory, we have this postulate, right? Because we have the Born rule and the spectral theorem, and we also have the projection postulate. Okay, so we have this kind of theory, and we want to describe a sequence of measurements using a physical theory like this. So suppose we prepare a physical system in a state row and we perform a measurement A1 over the system. We obtain an outcome alpha one, and the stage right after this measurement is rho one. And okay, but we also know what's the probability of obtaining this outcome in this measurement, given that rho is the stage right before the measurement. And okay, but we right after we perform a measurement A1, we can perform a measurement A2. And if we do that, we obtain an outcome and we have a final stage, which depends on alpha 2 and alpha 1, because it depends on rho 1. And we have this probability. And we can do that a third time, and we can do that as many times as we want. So we can do that any time. And in each measurement event, we know how to determine this probability. Okay, so now we have we have a question. So how can we define the probability of obtaining this sequence of outcomes in exactly this sequence of measurements, given that rho is the initial stage of our system? So how can we define such probability, given that we have those two postulates? Well, this definition seems natural. So note that here we have the probability of obtaining outcome alpha k, given that we are performing measurement ak in this stage. So we are just multiplying this number. So we are multiplying the probability which we obtain in each measurement event. Okay, so we can define this probability. It's well defined. And okay, so does it represent a joint measurement? Because when we say that we are performing a joint measurement of some observables, we are saying that we are performing these measurements at the same time. And okay, but here we have a sequence of measurements, but there is no time interval between them, right? Because the stage we use to determine, for example, this probability of obtaining outcome alpha 3 is the stage we obtain right after we perform a measurement A2. So there's no time interval between the measurements, and Maybe it makes sense to say that this is the probability of obtaining this joint outcome, because when we perform a joint measurement, when we perform a set of measurements at the same time, we obtain what we call a joint measurement, because for each observable we are measuring, we obtain an outcome. And if that's the case, if we can understand the sequence of measurements as a joint measurement, then this probability has to be the probability of obtaining this joint outcome in a joint measurement of these observables. So and does it make sense? So actually, in general, it's not a good idea, because there is a hidden dependence on order here. Because for example, this state row 1, 2, it depends on alpha 2 and depends on alpha 1, but it also may depend on the order we perform this measurement. So for example, if we change the order of A2 and A1, we will obtain a final state, which we can denote by row 2, 1. And we cannot use our postulates to say that both these states are the same state. So it depends on the theory. It depends on the rule we are using to determine such states. So there is this hidden dependence on order here. So we cannot say, but if we are thinking about joint measurements, there is no order, right? Because there is no order in this measurement, because there is no order given by a sequence given by the time we are performing the measurements, and there is no idea of order which is meaningful in a joint measurement. So, and this probability depends on the order. So in principle, it does not make sense to say that this is a joint measurement. Okay, so and a comparability context in a theory F satisfying those postulates is a set of observables in which we can understand this product we have defined as the probability of obtaining a joint outcome in a joint measurement of these observables. Because in a context, so take a context C, which is a set of observables in our theory. For any finite subset of C, we have this equality here. So what is pi A? Pi A is a permutation of the set A. So we are fixing an order in the set. And sigma A is the same thing. We are fixing an ordering. But and with this equation, we are saying that if the outcomes are the same, in the sense that for each measurement we are associating the same outcome, then the probability will be the same. So we are saying here that in a context, order doesn't matter. So these probabilities are always the same if the outcome is the same, in the sense is the same up to permutations. And it has to be true for any state. And if that's the case, we say that the set is a context. So that's the definition of a context in a theory F satisfying those postulates. So we have context, and now we can introduce what non-contextuality means. So we say that a physical theory F satisfying those postulates is non-contextual if the set of all its observables is a comparability context, in the sense that whatever is the finite set of measurements you fix, it's meaningful to talk about a joint measurement of these observables. Okay, so now let's see the standard examples to understand what we are doing here. So in quantum mechanics, in classical mechanics, given a physical system, we always have a phase space, which is this lambda here. I am assuming it has to be at least a measurable space. So this sigma is a sigma algebra. So we have a phase space, and states are probability measures over this phase space. So I am considering states of knowledge, and because we know that our physical system always have a well-defined pure state, but in many cases we don't know exactly what this state is. So that's why I am using probability measures. Observables are real measurable functions over the phase space. And okay, so now in order to understand the postulates, let's fix a stage, an observable, and an outcome. Well, what postulate one is in classical mechanics? What's the probability of obtaining outcome alpha given that you are performing measurement F in the state me? Well, we just apply our measure over this set here. It's an event in the sense of classical probability theory. And note that it's true that we obtain an outcome alpha in a measurement of F if and only if our pure state, the pure state of our system, belongs to the set. So the set, this event, represents this measurement event, and then we just apply our measure over this event. And well, postulate two, we have a state of knowledge, right? So when we perform a measurement and we obtain an outcome, this collapse of our state is an upgrade of our knowledge about the system. So if we obtain outcome alpha in a measurement of F, we know that our pure state belongs to this event here. And that's why we just restrict our measure over this event and normalize it in order to obtain a new probability measure. So, so these are the postulates in classical mechanics. And if we fix a sequence of measurements in classical mechanics, any sequence, and we apply that definition given by the product of the probability in each measurement event, we obtain exactly this number. And we have two important things here. The first thing is that there is no order dependence here. So whatever is the order we fix for these measurements, if the outcome is the same up to permutations, so if we change the order of the sequence and change the order of these outcomes, then the probability will be the same. So there is no order dependence. And moreover, this is exactly how we calculate probabilities for joint measurements in classical mechanics, right? Because in classical mechanics, we assume that it's meaningful to consider joint measurements. And that's exactly how we calculate the probability of obtaining this joint outcome in a joint measurement of its observable. So that definition makes sense in classical mechanics. And finally, classical mechanics is a non-contextual theory because the set of all its observables is a context. Okay, and what about quantum theory? Well, in quantum theory, we know the postulates, right? So we have the Born rule and the spectral theorem, and these are the postulate one. And we have postulate two is the projection theorem. So take a sequence of measurements, which you can understand as a measurement is or a bounded subadjoint operator or a PVM. So I am thinking about sharp measurements. So fix the sequence of measurements. And for this sequence of outcomes in a stage site, so it's sufficient to consider pure states. So this product is this expected value. So it's the expected value of self-adjoint operator. And well, here we see that order matters, right? We cannot just change the order of this measurement and apply the same permutation in the set of, if we apply a permutation in this sequence of measurements and apply the same permutation in the sequence of outcomes, the result we will obtain will not be the same. So there is an order dependence in quantum theory, as we know. And moreover, but in the case in which these operators commute, we see that order doesn't matter because now these projections commute. And moreover, we obtain exactly the rule we use in quantum mechanics to ascribe probabilities of for joint outcomes in joint measurements. Because again, in quantum theory, we assume that if these operators commute, then it's meaningful to talk about a joint measurement and we represent the probability of some joint outcome in a joint measurement using the joint spectrum of these elements. So, and we do that using exactly this rule. So this definition we have seen in the introduction, in which we understand, we define a probability for a sequence of outcomes using a product, is exactly what we use in quantum and classical theory when we want to describe joint measurements, right? So in context, that sequence of measurements can be understood as a joint measurement. That sequence of measurements can be understood as a joint measurement, right? It makes sense for context. That's why I am saying that a context is a set of observables for which it's meaningful to talk about a joint measurement. Okay, so how can we define context in quantum theory? Well, it's just a collection of commuting bounded self-adjoint operators, or a collection of component-wise commuting PVMs, if you prefer. And quantum theory is a contextual theory in this sense we have introduced, right? Okay, so now so we have contextuality in physical theories. And well, it makes sense to construct some approach or some frameworks to understand this condition in itself, right? So to describe contextuality. And that's what the comparability hypergraph approach tried to do. So let's briefly introduce this approach. The first definition we need is the definition of a comparability scenario. So a comparability scenario is just a triple of sets. And so X is a finite set. And the idea is that the elements of the set represent measurements we can perform over some physical system. The set O is a finite set, and the idea is that the elements of the set are outcomes for these measurements. And C is a collection of context. So a context is a subset of X, and we have to fix a collection of context in order to define a comparability scenario. And we impose some conditions over this set of contexts. The first condition is that any measurement belongs to a context. And the second condition is that we don't allow any subcontext. And okay, that's what a comparability scenario is. And now we can introduce behaviors. Okay, so we are thinking about joint measurements we perform over context. So fix a context C. How can we represent a joint outcome of a joint measurement in this context? Well, we can do that using a function from C to O, because a function associates for each element of this context, for each measurement, an outcome. And that's how we represent outcomes for joint measurements. And the set of all these functions, or all these joint outcomes, is the set OC here. And okay, so now for a context C, we can define a probability distribution over the set of joint outcomes in C. And a behavior is just a mapping, or is a mapping which fixes for each context one probability distribution, right? So it's a contextual collection of probability distribution. So that's what a behavior is. Okay, so we have these two elements. There is a very important technical definition, which is the definition of a marginal distribution. So fix a context C, and fix any subset E of C. We can use the component C of our behavior. So we usually denote a behavior by P, and the component C of this behavior is what we denote by PC. So take the component C of a behavior P. We can define a distribution over this set, so over the set of joint outcomes for our joint measurements we perform over the subset P. So we can define a distribution using the component C of our behavior. And this definition is just the marginal distribution of this component C. So, and this idea of marginal distribution will be important in almost all definitions we are going to introduce. Okay, so Okay, so now, so we have scenarios and behaviors, and in the comparability hypergraph approach, we characterize contextuality and other conditions. Characterizing behaviors, we can define over scenarios. So, for example, so we fix a scenario, and we have a lot of possible behaviors we can define over the scenario, and we can classify such behaviors. So we can, and non-contextuality is an example of it. So non-contextuality is appropriate for behaviors, and we say that a behavior is non-contextual if it exists what we call a global section for this behavior. So if exists a distribution over this set, so and the idea is that this is the set of joint outcomes. For joint measurements, we perform over all measurements at the same time, right? So it seems that, so when we discuss the quantum and when we discuss non-contextuality for physical theories, we said that a physical theory is non-contextual if the set of all its observables is a context. And here the idea is similar. So we are saying that in some sense it's we can perform joint measurements over the set of all measurements. And so a behavior is non-contextual if exists a distribution like this, such that in any context, see, the marginal of this distribution of this global section max with our component C, with the component C of our behavior. So if there exists some global section like this, we say that the behavior is non-contextual. But there are other ways of classifying behaviors which are important. And the idea of classical behavior is a very natural one. So we say that a behavior is classical if it has a classical model, in the sense that exists probability space, lambda. And we can associate each measurement in our scenario to a random variable over this probability space lambda. And finally, we can, in some sense, reconstruct our behavior using this classical model. So here we see that we are using exactly we have a joint outcome for a joint measurement over this context C, but this is exactly how we calculate such joint outcome in classical probability theory or classical mechanics, right? So that's what a classical behavior is, a behavior which has a classical model. And it's easy to prove that a behavior is classical if and only if it's non-contextual, which means that classicality and non-contextuality, from this point of view, are the same thing. And okay, and it's also important to the idea of a quantum behavior. And a behavior P over a scenario X is a quantum behavior if exists a quantum model for it, in the sense that we can fix some finite dimensional Hilbert space H, and we can associate each measurement in our scenario to a bounded self-adjoint operator or a PVM. We also can fix a density operator such that some conditions are satisfied. The first condition is that each contact in our scenario is associated to a context in quantum theory, so to a collection of operators which commutes. And finally, we can use this quantum system. Okay, so sorry about that. And well, we have quantum behaviors, which, as I have said, are behaviors having quantum models. So we can fix some finite dimensional Hilbert space, and we can associate each measurement in our scenario to a bounded self-adjoint operator or a PVM. And we also have a density operator such that we associate each context in our scenario to a context in quantum mechanics, and you can use this quantum system to describe our behavior, right? So that's what a quantum behavior is. Okay, so and when we fix a behavior, sorry, when we fix the scenario, we are able to classify the behaviors we can define over the scenario, and we can do that with non-contextual behaviors or classical behaviors and contextual behaviors. And as we should expect, when we do that, the general result is this one. So in general, the set of quantum behaviors is greater than the set of non-contextual or classical behaviors. So, okay, so we have this result. And the last important definition we are going to introduce is the definition of non-disturbance. So we say that a behavior is non-disturbing if, so take two contexts C and D with non-empty intersection. We say that a behavior is non-disturbing when the marginal defined by the component C and the component D of this behavior coincides in the intersection, right? And it has to be satisfied for any pair of contexts C and D. And if that's the case, we say that our behavior is non-disturbing. And this condition for Bell scenarios implies non-signaling. So it's a well-motivated definition. And that's the result. So if we classify the behaviors we can define over a scenario, in general, the set of non-disturbing behaviors is greater than the set of quantum behaviors. Okay, now let's briefly introduce the contextuality by default approach. So in this approach, we are dealing with random variables instead of behaviors. And the main idea in the framework is that a property, or in our terminology, a measurement, is represented by a collection of random variables depending on the context C. So we represent a measurement using random variables, but a measurement has to be represented not by one random variable, but by a collection of random variables. For each context containing the measurement, we associate a different random variable. So, it's okay. So that's the idea. So in order to understand what they are doing here, it's important to have to bear in mind what a random variable is. So fix a probability space and a measurable space. A random variable on lambda with values on O is no more than a measurable function from lambda to O. So that's what a random variable is. And okay, so now we can introduce systems, which is the main definition in their approach. And it's analogous to a scenario and a behavior. So what a system is. So they fix a set of measurements and a set of contexts. A context is a subset of the set of measurements. For each measurement and each context C containing the measurement, we associate a random variable, which we label using the context and the measurement. And a system is this triple of sets where R is the set of all these random variables, right? So we consider the all random variables. So for all context and all measurement, and that's what a system is. But we have to impose some conditions over a system. And the first condition is that, so fix a context C. For this context, we have what they call a bunch, which is the collection of all random variables labeled by C. And we have to impose that these random variables are jointly distributed. And what does it mean? It means that they have a joint distribution. And okay, but it happens when the random variables have the same domain. So that's why I think it's important to have a clear idea to understand random variables as functions, because we can understand what does it mean to say that the random variables have a joint distribution. And it's a very important idea in their approach. So, okay, and that's the case. So for a context, we can always fix a probability space, and all random variables labeled by this context have the same domain. So we have this bunch, and this bunch is in some sense, it's a classical system. Okay, and but they also impose that if we have two random variables labeled by different contexts, then they are stochastically unrelated, which means that they do not have a joint distribution. And it happens when these random variables have different domains. So that's the general picture of what a system is. So for each context, we have a probability space. And for each context, we have this bunch, which is a collection of random variables defined on this probability space. And the collection of all these bunches is a system. And that's the kind of thing they use to describe measurements and to describe contextuality action. Okay, so now we can introduce contextuality by default in the comparability hypergraph approach to contextuality. So, and we do that using behaviors to define random variables, right? Because it seems natural. So if you express both formulations using the same ideas, using random variables, then it becomes clear what is the relation between them. So let's use behaviors to define random variables. So now here we are thinking about the comparability hypergraph approach. So we have a scenario and we have a measurement X in this scenario. We have a context containing our measurement. We can define a probability distribution over the set of outcomes using the marginal, right? Because so we have the component C of our behavior. The singleton X is a subset of C. It's a distribution over the set of outcomes. And we can define this distribution PCX for this measurement and this context containing the measurement. And okay, and when we do that, we are associating, for this measurement X, a collection of probability distributions. And we have for each context containing the measurement, a different distribution. Okay, but if we have a probability distribution over the set O, we have our random variables with values on O, because O is a finite set and any probability distribution is the distribution of some random variable. So, but moreover, in a context, we have the component. So in a context C, we have the component C of our behavior. So when we fix a behavior over a scenario, we can associate for each context a probability space. And such that for any measurement in this context, this random variable, which we are associating to this probability distribution, is a random variable defined on this probability space. By definition, the distribution of this random variable is the distribution we have defined. And finally, the component C of our behavior is exactly the joint distribution of these random variables. Okay, so we see that a context. So when we fix a behavior over a scenario, each context defines a bunch. And so we see that a behavior defines a scenario over the system. So, we have these results. So fix a behavior and it defines a system. But there is I think it's important to consider the case of quantum observable quantum behaviors, because we have seen that we have quantum behaviors, which are behaviors which have quantum models, and in this case we our measurements are bounded self-adjoint operators or PVMs, and it may seem weird to say that now these measurements which was bounded self-adjoint operators, now they can be represented by random variables, and each context now is a probability space, and it may seem that there is no physical meaning in these definitions, right? So it works, but it has no physical meaning. But actually, it's not the case, and it can be understood from the point of view of the Gelfand transform and the Hissing-Markov theorem. Because so a context C is a collection of operators which commutes And we can associate this, this context to a measurable space, which is, so this VC here is the phonemal algebra, the commutative phonemal algebra generated by the set. And this lambda is the Gelfand spectrum of this algebra. And when we are using the Gelfand transform. So we can associate each bounded self-adjoint operator in this context to a continuous function over this Gelfand spectrum here, because we have a topology, so it's meaningful to talk about continuous functions. And if we use the Hilbert-Markov theorem, we can transform each state in our quantum system in a probability measure over this measurable space. So this theorem tells us that it's meaningful to understand each context as a probability space, because we have the Gelfand transform and this theorem. And moreover, in this context, each measurement, which is a bounded self-adjoint operator, now is a random variable. It's a measurable function. So it's meaningful to, so these theorems, they say that each context defines a bunch, and in the quantum case, it's meaningful to understand this random variable. So it has a well-defined physical meaning. Okay, so now we see that a behavior defines a scenario. The definition is very natural. And now we can introduce context values by default in the compatibility hypergraph approach, just using the system which behavior defines. The way we introduce context values by default is using the system defined by behavior. And for example, if in context values by default, we have a property A, we say that a behavior satisfies this property A if the system defined by this behavior satisfies such properties. So, and the first property, the first condition we introduce is constant connectedness. So that's the definition. Now we are considering systems. And take a measurement X in a system. We have this Rx is the collect, which they call a connection, is the collection of all random variables labeled by X. And a system is said to be constantly connected if all random variables in a given connection have the same distribution. And if we are thinking about the system defined by behavior, it means that, so fix a measurement X and take two contexts C and D containing X, it means that these random variables are the same, whatever is this context C and D. And therefore we can ignore this index C here, because all these probabilities are the same probability. So we can when the system defined by behavior is constantly connected, we can associate for each measurement one and only one random variable. And it means that this idea of constant connectedness draws the line between two views on measurements. So the first view is the view they introduce, in which we have to understand the measurements as collections of random variables. And the second view is the view in which each measurement has to be understood as one and only one random variable. Because if the distributions of all random variables we associate to a measurement are the same, then from an experimental point of view, these random variables are the same, because in a laboratory, we just have access to distributions, right? So this definition is very important in their approach, because it draws this line. Okay, and as we have said, if the system defined by behavior is constantly connected, we say that the behavior is non-degenerate. It's just a new name for the same condition. We use this word non-degenerate. Okay, now in order to introduce what we call extended context values, we have to understand what a coupling is. So if we have a finite set of random variables, these random variables not necessarily have a well-defined joint distribution, because they have different domains. But we can, as they say, we can force a joint distribution for these random variables. And how can we do that? Well, we can do that fixing a sequence of random variables with the same domain, therefore with a joint distribution, such that for each component, so for example, our random variable R1 is equivalent to this random variable S1 in the sense that they have the same distribution, right? So they are random variables with values on the same set. So it's meaningful to say that they have the same distribution. And if a coupling for this set, the sequence of random variables, is a collection of random variables satisfying these two conditions here. And couplings always exist. Actually, it's very, very easy to construct a coupling. Okay, but we also have to understand what a maximal coupling is. And well, fix a coupling S for a sequence of random variables. This is the joint distribution of this coupling is a distribution over this set, so O to the power of N. And the definition is exactly the definition we have seen in quantum in classical mechanics. So the probability of obtaining this joint outcome in a joint measurement of these random variables is this measure here. It's the push-forward measure. It's a well-known definition. And okay, and it makes sense to define the probability of these random variables being equal, given that we are working with this coupling S. And we define this probability using this sum. Actually, it can be defined as an event. So it makes sense. And a coupling is maximal if for any, so a coupling S is maximal if for any other coupling S prime we fix for this collection of random variables, the probability of these random variables being equal is greater than the probability given by just coupling S prime. So maximal coupling maximizes the probability of our random variables being the same. Okay, that's what a maximal coupling is. And finally, we can introduce what they call maximally non-contextual description for a system. So a system is said to have a maximally non-contextual description if there is a coupling, which provides a maximal coupling for each connection. So if this coupling maximizes the probability of all random variables we have associated to this measurement X being the same. And how we introduce extended, we call extended contextuality. So we say that a behavior is non-contextual in the extended sense if the system defined by this behavior has a maximally non-contextual description. So now we have seen how we can introduce contextuality by default in the comparability hypergraph approach. And now we can, just to finish the presentation, what are the results, right? So what happens when we introduce the ideas in the comparability hypergraph approach? Regarding non-degeneracy, we proved that non-disturbance implies non-degeneracy and that non-degeneracy does not imply non-disturbance, as we should expect, actually. When we introduce non-degeneracy in the comparability hypergraph approach, we obtain a new set of behaviors. And the set defined as a polytope, as the set of non-contextual behaviors do, and the set of non-disturbing behaviors. And so, okay, so we have this new kind of behaviors, and we can classify the set of behaviors using a finite set of linear inequalities. So people like to do that in this framework. So we have this new set of behaviors in which they can work on. Okay, so what about extended non-contextuality? So this is the set of non-degenerate behaviors, and this is the set of behaviors which are non-contextual in the extended sense. And again, as we should expect, the set of non-contextual behaviors is exactly the intersection between the set of behaviors which are non-contextual. Regarding extended non-contextuality, so the set of behaviors which are non-contextual in the standard sense is exactly the intersection between the set of behaviors which are non-contextual in the extended sense and the set of non-degenerative behaviors, which means that non-contextuality, which means that a behavior is non-contextual if and only if it's non-degenerate and non-contextual in the extended sense. And actually, this definition have already been introduced in this paper by Barbara and Cristiano Duarte. They classify, they introduce extended contextuality in the contextuality by default approach using what they call extended scenarios and behaviors. And this definition, which we have introduced here, in which we define a behavior when we say that a behavior is non-contextual in the extended sense, when the system defined by behavior has a maximally non-contextual description, is exactly the definition they have introduced. So actually, this work is the motivation of this work. So okay, so finally, summary of our results. So okay, so if we fix a scenario and classify all behaviors we can define over the scenario, we have something like this. So this yellow square is the set of non-contextual behaviors, and we have the set of quantum behaviors and the set of non-disturbing behaviors. This is the kind of classification people usually do in this approach. And now we have this greater set of behaviors which are non-degenerate. And well, if contextuality by default is meaningful, if these ideas they have introduced are meaningful, then classifying the set using a finite set of linear inequalities seems a good idea, right? And okay, so we have this new kind of behavior, which is the set of non-degenerate behaviors. And I think it can be interested when we are thinking about Bell scenarios, for example. And okay, and we have the set of behaviors which are non-contextual in the extended sense. And okay, and again, if this idea behind contextuality by default is meaningful, if non-contextuality in the extended sense is a meaningful idea, then well, it's important to work with behaviors which are outside the set of non-degenerate behaviors. So because if we restrict our behaviors to the set of non-degenerate behaviors, we are non-contextuality in the extended sense is not meaningful anymore, because it's exactly non-contextuality in the standard sense. So work with behaviors outside of the set may be important. And okay, and we see that this idea behind contextuality by default is implicit in the comparability hypergraph approach to contextuality, in the sense that it's just a matter of choose the right behavior, right? Because the own definition of behavior implies that if we want to understand the measurements as random variables in the comparability hypergraph approach, we have to accept that a behavior is a collection of random variables. Then you have one random variable for each context containing that measurement. So in the sense that I say that the idea is implicit, right? Okay, and finally, we can relax the non-disturbance condition as a physical requirement, because people usually impose non-disturbance in order to say that the behavior you are working with has a physical meaning. But if contextuality by default is something which we have to consider, then we cannot restrict ourselves to the set of behaviors, to the set of non-disturbing behaviors, because the set is a subset of the set of non-degenerate behaviors. So if contextuality by default works, we have to relax this physical requirement here. And that's it. That's what we have done. And thank you again. And sorry about the problems with my internet connection.
Let's thank the speaker. Okay, time for questions.
I have a question. So this is more about the kind of, I guess, the assumptions you're using. So you mentioned at the start when you're setting up the framework with joint measurements and context, that you were assuming that measurements were projective, like PVMs, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was wondering if it would be like, is there maybe motivation or is it possible to extend to POVMs? And the reason I'm asking is in the kind of experimental scenario, you wouldn't expect your, you know, the measurements you actually do to be maybe some noise, for instance, they would be modeled by projectors necessarily, but more by POVMs. So I was wondering, like, yeah, is this something that's worth extending to, or what were your thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea. Try to extend these results to POVMs. Of course, it's a good idea. But if it's how can we do that, right? It's not clear for me. So yes, it's a good idea. Work with POVMs, but I don't know how to do that because
I guess issues with the post measurement state, like definitions of it, maybe, because you kind of rely on sequential measurements, and I guess this would be like, yeah.
Yes. I think everything is not so easy to understand, right? Because I am all the time thinking about projections, so I think it's a good idea, but it's not clear to me why we could do that.
Okay.
Can I just add to the? Oh, I'm sorry. Go on, Alison.
There is a second problem regarding the quantum case, because in order to define these random variables in quantum mechanics, I have said that we can use the Galton transform and the Hissing-Markov theorem to understand quantum mechanics from this point of view of random variables, because we can associate each commutative algebra to a measurable space and so on. But in these theorems, you have to represent your measurement not using a bounded surface operator. So I have no idea how we could describe some kind of Galton transform for POVMs, right? Because when you are working with PVMs, you have the spectral theorem. So your PVM is some kind of equivalence class of bounded surface operators. And for POVMs, I don't know how can you associate an operator to a POVM, right? So I don't know how to do that. So, but I think, of course, it's a very good idea.
Let me just add to Alison's answer is that this is one of the main criticisms to this approach to contextuality, that we all of these definitions, they are assuming that you have projective measurements, and we know that this is a problem when you go to experiments. And this approach to contextuality, it goes in one direction of not assuming projective measurements, but not assuming that they necessarily have to commute at the time. That you have, like in this standard notion that we see, we have two notions, and one of them is that you have projective measurements, and the second one is that they have to commute perfectly. And we know that it's never going to happen in the lab. So this goes in one direction of trying to get rid of these relations that of the non-disturbance condition, and we still have this assumption that is not good for experiments, that you have projective measurement, and it was not our intention to get rid of these here, and we still don't know how to do that. So this notion of contextuality has this problem, and this does not solve that. So just it's one step towards dealing with experimental data, but we still have this issue and we do not solve this here. So it's not our intention to do that.
Okay, thanks.
More questions?
Alison, I was wondering if you could clarify for me the distinction between non-degeneracy and non-disturbance. Superficially, it looks like non-disturbance is a stronger condition in that if there is more than one measurement which overlaps between two contexts, let's say you have two measurements in common between context one and context two, then that intersection has to have the exact same distribution regardless of context, is what non-disturbance would tell us. Whereas non-degeneracy says, no, each random variable by itself has to have the same distribution regardless of context, but the joint distribution over the intersecting random variables could differ. Is there more to it than that? Because if that's the only difference, it seems to me like we could say, for any context where you have a bunch of random variables, you can sort of artificially imagine additional sort of composite random variables, which is like a random variable which has a tuple of outcomes corresponding to like both of the random variables that you want. And then applying non-degeneracy to sort of these composite random variables is exactly the same as applying non-disturbance to the whole set. Or no? Can you say more?
Yes, the distinction is exactly what you have said. So non-degeneracy implies that if you have a point in an intersection, then and you have two contexts, so take two contexts C and D, and take a point in the intersection, then the marginal defined by C in this point is the same as the marginal defined by D in this point, right? Mm-hmm. And non-disturbance means that the marginal of C in the entire intersection is the same distribution as the marginal of D in the entire intersection. So I think that's exactly what you have said, right?
Yes. Yeah, but okay, good. So I'm glad that I'm not misreading you. So then, like, why would you imagine that you would ever have a set of random variables which would sort of for philosophical reasons exclude random variables which should simply encode everything regarding some compatible set? So like if C and D appear in both contexts, then I could just consider like the CD observable as one observable, which if like C has certain, you know, so many outcomes and D has so many outcomes, then I can just create some sort of integer base using cardinality C and cardinality D and encode a single random variable in that sort of higher cardinality space. And that seems to me like this is, it's not like I'm doing a different experiment. It's just a different way of thinking about the observables. And so because I could think about the observables as having a joint observable with very high cardinality, unless you can tell me why I shouldn't imagine that thought experiment, I don't see why I should treat non-degeneracy and non-disturbance any differently.
Okay, so I don't know if I get exactly what you are trying to say, but I understand this distinction from a very mathematical point of view, in the sense that we can prove that it's not true that when a behavior satisfies non-degeneracy, then this behavior satisfies non-disturbance. So you can just construct an example in which it's not the case. And that's
Let me try one more time to sort of clarify what I'm saying. Suppose that you have a behavior which is a disturbing behavior that satisfies that it's non-degenerate.
Okay.
If I then take that same behavior and I introduce one more random variable to each context, which is sort of one high cardinality random variable encoding the intersection of the sort of the contexts, then all of a sudden, just by introducing this additional random variable, which is just like a mathematical operation, it becomes from non-degenerate to all of a sudden degenerate. So like degeneracy versus non-degeneracy is not a stable distinction. I can take a thing which is non-degenerate and make it degenerate sort of by hand without really doing anything.
Mm-hmm. To be honest, I don't know how to answer this question. And so, I don't have any.
Let me try to help here a little bit. So yes, you are right. The definition of degeneracy and non-disturbance depends on how you define what are going to be your measurements in the terminology we use here, and how you attribute a random variable to a measurement. So of course you can always think of a random variable that is measuring two measurements, like joint measurements of the same. So if you do that, the definitions are the same, because you're just constructing your random variables in a way that the intersections of the sets will be just one point. So whenever this happens, then the two notions are the same. So yes, you are correct. But we haven't talked on the... So it's basically a problem of the way you construct your random variables. And thinking now, I don't see any way why it's so fundamental that we have to deal with the random variables separately. But I have to think a little bit more about that. We haven't thought about these issues. Of course, this is true. But I don't know, I can answer now, if this has any deeper consequences to what we're doing. Because we always think about the random variables associated to the individual measurements, and we started from there. But of course you can define your random variables in a different way. But does it help, or it's equivalent, it doesn't make any difference? It doesn't seem to make, but we have to think a little bit more about that.
Can I say something? When I think about Bell scenarios, this distinction between non-disturbance and non-degenerates seems clear to me, because it seems that, so I don't know, I don't understand Bell scenarios very well, but so it's just a very superficial point of view. So when we say that a behavior has to be non-degenerate, we are saying that so we will have a scenario with any parts, right? So we are saying that one person cannot be able to notice the interference of this other measurements in the measurement this person is applying. And when we say that a behavior has to be non-disturbing, we are saying that if we fix I don't know, for example, three parts of the system, we are saying that the joint distribution of these parts cannot we were saying that I don't know what's the correct word, but the joint distribution of this so sorry I don't know how to say exactly what I am trying to say, but I think about signaling, right? Because when I think about signaling, I think that one person cannot I don't know how to express exactly what I'm trying to say, but
I think this is perfect. I'm really glad that you bring up this analogy, because for me, this whole question was inspired by thinking about no signaling in multi-parted Bell scenarios. Because what we usually say we encode no signaling is that, like, the choice of Alice's measurements can't impact anybody else. So there is a random variable corresponding to, like, the outcome of Bob's measurement. There's a random variable corresponding to the outcome of Charlie's measurement. But no signaling traditionally means the entire joint distribution of Bob and Charlie is stable regardless of Alice changing her outcome. And so, like, all of the random variables are have the same distribution regardless of what Alice does, which is a lot closer to non-disturbance than it is to non-degeneracy. And this is, you know, not entirely an abstract conversation. Like, if you're giving a prescription for how to test contextuality by default or extended contextuality when you have three or more compatible measurements, like when you go from the graph compatibility to the hypergraph compatibility, the question is, do you really only impose maximal coupling for observables where an observable is one measurement, or do you imagine these sort of composite random variables and you impose maximal coupling on the composite random variables as well? And now you're going to get a different answer. Like, whether or not you have a behavior, whether or not it's extended contextual in a hypergraph scenario, you're going to get a different answer whether you impose maximal coupling on individual random variables or maximal coupling on composite random variables. So, like, we have to get this straight.
Yeah.
And it depends on the way you define things. And it also may be helpful in one scenario and in one application and not the other. But this example of Bell scenarios is great, because in one case, you just have to check your distribution here in your, each experimentalist has to check its distribution. In the other, you have to check, like, joint distribution. So you have to think about them jointly. So this is a case where it does make sense physically to distinguish the two situations.
Okay. Are there more questions? Okay, if not, we should thank our speaker again and also everybody for the discussion.